Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. It's me, Andy Kirkpatrick. Another big gap, I do apologise, in my podcasting. I keep trying to get around to doing it, but I don't seem to have any time at the moment. So I'm here, I'm sat in the on the kitchen table, and I can see out the window, I can see Noah, and he's playing in the sandpit outside. Probably got the most expensive high... I can already hear his furry shouting now. Daddy, I'm playing in the big pool of water or something. Probably got the most expensive sandpit in the world. I was around the back of our house. So this house we live in was kind of partly built by Vanessa, my wife's dad. But no one's ever lived in it. And it's an interesting story, but we'll go into it anyway. But it was... I probably mentioned it before. It's a very Irish thing. Anyway, so but around the back of his house, he had all this wood that he must have bought like 30, 40 years ago, and it was like really expensive kind of wood that would last forever, like some kind of Canadian redwood or something, or some kind of, you know, sacred kind of fancy wood. And it must have been pretty good wood, because it'd been out in the horrific weather for years and years and years out, and it was still in quite a good condition. And then whenever he came round, he'd always come round and be like, look after that wood, you know, be careful of that wood, you know, don't do anything with it, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah. Anyway, so one day I was like paranoid about the coming food apocalypse. So I started making loads of raised beds, and there was loads of wood all over the place. I was like finding general bits of wood. Some of it was like kind of rotten, but I was like making like raised beds in one part of the garden. And we have like a weird garden in the part. It's actually quite a big area. Like where we live, it was a farmer, and he basically was like he had like 16 kids. And they lived, you know, like totally destitute. I think maybe in the last podcast I mentioned that, like, you know, there's a photograph. I went to someone's house, and he's like one of the children who's, you know, he actually recently just died, that guy. But he, you know, had a picture of like his brother, like wearing a dress, because he didn't have enough money to buy him any clothes. He had a hand-me-down dress. But anyway, so the farm, the only thing he had was this land that nobody wanted. It was the land here is incredibly full of rocks, like to an insane, like if you dig a meter deep hole, a meter by meter hole, you would end up with at least like two rocks the size of a microwave or something, and then a lot of other rocks of various sizes. It's just like, it must be some kind of glacial spoil, wherever this is. So Yeah, so it wasn't really good for anything. You could put cows on it. So they had cows and things growing up, but they had some cows. So they basically lived off the milk from the cow and probably had some horses and stuff, whatever. But as each child grew up, they were given like a piece of land that they eventually when they had money. Like a lot of them left Ireland and went to live in England, some went to live in America. But when they came back and they had enough money, then they would have this piece of land that they would like build a house on. And then their children then got some land and then they built houses on it. So where we live is like a lot of the people are all the same extended family. And now you have like the grandchildren have got land that they're building houses on. So it's kind of interesting. So, but I expect every generation of the Currans is probably, you know, they're not having like 16 kids. So anyway, but this land is my mother-in-law is related to the Curran. So this is like her piece of land that you got this piece of land and they built this house over like 20 years or something, like bit by bit. So it's kind of cool. Anyway, but for some reason her dad had this great idea that he wanted to build a tennis court in his back garden. So it's quite, as I say, it's quite a big, well, it's not a back garden, it's like a piece of like some land with just full of massive rocks and stuff. Like if you were a dwarf, and you have to be smaller than a dwarf, if you were like a fairy, not as in a, you know, like a, not as a 1970s gay person, if you were like a, you know, a very small, it wouldn't be human. If you were like one of those guys out of Willow or something, or some other small person, I don't think Lord of the Rings has got any really small people in it. I can't really where's it? Anyway, if you're like Tom Thumb or somebody, I don't know. If you're like the Incredible Shrinking Man, but not to the point where you're the size of an atom, then you'd be all right, yeah, because there'd be loads of rocks if you had to boulder on. Although you probably won't go bouldering. So, so he had this idea he was going to build a tennis court because my wife was really good at tennis, and which is kind of stupid because she went to a tennis club. She never became a professional because it was like it didn't have an indoor part of it, and it's like in Galway, so the weather is like horrific, so you could only play tennis like 5 days a year. So anyway, so he built this this tennis. Well, he didn't build a tennis court. That's the problem. He just laid down he made the flat part with a digger, and then he like covered it with stones to like, you know, hard just stones ready for eventually putting what tarmac on top of it or whatever. We never got round. He never got round to doing the tarmac. So when I moved in here, it was like literally like a, you know, it was like a jungle. It was like, you know, you couldn't see out the windows because it was just a jungle. So I went out there and I spent like a month or whatever, like trying to cut it all down, all this overgrowth. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. This, like, I've got this perfectly, perfectly smooth lawn. Like once, you know, I've got rid of all the stuff, it's going to be amazing. Where's Noah gone? Disappeared. Oh, anyway, so I thought it was going to be amazing. You know, it's like job done. I'll just mow it all, and then it'd be fine. And then I think I realised it wasn't grass; it was just like moss. So I tried to dig into it, see what it was, and it's just stones with like moss on top. So it's not really. I don't know why I'm telling you this story. Anyway, not only have I got like a garden which is like 50% rocks, the best part of the garden is like 99.999% rocks and the rest of it's like moss. But when I was building these raised beds, because you can't really grow potatoes in stones, Vanessa was like, I'm gonna make a sand pit. Like, this is the thing. The older I get, the more I kind of realize the men and women are completely incompatible. And like I've gone, I'm really going back to like a 1970s view of men and women, because I think it was probably actually more correct, I think. Because just men and women are just totally incompatible. And I think part of one reason why the world is going to hell is because women have been given too much, you know, it's like when people say like, oh, everyone's the same. That's just not true. Like if you travel around the world, it's just not true. Like people are very different, and men and women are very different, and men are very different. So it's every, you know, anyway, but this is a classic, so like the other day we're driving the car and we've got this like baby, like 2-month-old baby. So Vanessa's in the back with the baby, and because it's Ireland, you don't bother with like seat belts or anything like that. And but she's like complaining. She's like worrying that the baby's got some sick on her overalls or whatever they wear. And I'm like, Vanessa, have you got your seatbelt on? And she's like, oh no. And I'm like, if we have a crash, like it's okay going in the back of the car, just holding the baby and not sticking it in the car seat. But you need to wear your seatbelt, because if you do have a crash, you're just going to squash the baby. And she's kind of like, you know, but that's a real different, like she's worrying about a bit of sick on her baby grow, and I'm thinking about the baby dying. So it's like weird. Anyway, but so I'm worried about the food apocalypse, and I'm like, you know, like trying to work, reading loads of books and see how quick I can grow some potatoes or something. You can grow potatoes very well in Ireland. I know some of that might come as a shock. It's a great place for growing potatoes. You know, and Vanessa's like, oh, I'm going to make a sand pit. Like, you know, like, I guess you could, what could you use a sand pit for? Like nothing, basically. So anyway, so she embarks on this like multi-week sand pit project, if not month, and probably cost, you know, she ended up, she was like we've got a fucking bloody beach, right? Like we've got a beach just there. You could walk down to the beach and get like some sand. Anyway, but she bought some sand. She bought like 160 euros worth of sand. And, you know, it's like, it's just a different way because it's cleaner, that sand. It's not cleaner when the cat's been pissing in it and the whatever. But anyway, I came back one day and I was like, where do you get the wood for building that? She built the walls of this like ginormous, it could be a swimming pool basically, this ginormous, it's bigger than the beach. So I was like, where do you get that wood from? She said, oh, my dad had all this wood around the back of the house. You know, so it's like, so now it's probably one of the most deluxe, you know, people probably drive past and go, Christ, those people must be wealthy in that house. Like, look at the size of that. Look, they're so rich. They you know, they've basically got a swimming pool, but they've just filled it full of sand. Like, that's how rich they are. So, actually, speaking of it, I'm just going to check that Noah's disappeared out of the sandpit. One second. It's okay. It's lurking. It's lurking somewhere else. Actually, in the food apocalypse, I basically dug up loads of the garden. It's trying to work out where I could plant some something. And there's loads of holes in the garden. He likes to play in those holes. They're not too deep. Anyway, so it's actually got a, she made a lid for it. So once she built the sand pit and then she put the sand in, that was like a massive multi-month project. It took her the whole of the summer. And then she built this lid, which is made out of like plywood, which weighs about 50 kilos when it's dry, which being where we live, it's never dry. So it probably weighs, it's getting like 70 kilos, 100 kilos when it's like wet. The only way to get it off is you can just lift up one corner and like pull it, slide it off. If it goes all the way, then it needs two people to get back on it because it's so heavy. So it's very interesting. Anyway, I don't want to bore you with all my first world problems out my sandpit, but it is actually, if you ever get the chance to build a sandpit for your kids, it is pretty good. Like he sleeps out there. You know, that's how good it is. It's actually bigger than the house. So he's got like a cabana out there and stuff. It's cool. Like people often come there. People often like land there in boats and like ask where Galway is. I'm like, this is actually the sandpit. Galway's up there. That's the beaches down there. So yeah, so sandpits are quite good. Those plastic ones, like a big frog, are probably, they probably cost you like €30. Probably get one free off like Dundee or off eBay or something. So I just get one of them. And I think the sand off the beach, like here there's a lot of sewage. Like Ireland's got the largest number of septic tanks in Europe. So, and the septic tank is just like a fancy way of saying you just shit and it goes in the river and then goes into the sea. And so the water's, I think the water's very polluted in Ireland. Like you don't want to swim with your mouth open and stuff. So that's probably, it's probably not good to get the sand off the beach because it's probably got like condoms and tampons and things with ons in. So yeah. So yeah, so I have been meaning to do this podcast, another podcast for ages and ages, and I've noticed I've got this like build up of like emails from people asking me questions, and usually I just reply, but I've been like saving them. So people are probably like, oh God, he's up himself. I sent him this question, you know, and he's not replied to me. So I do take these things. I do, you know. You know, often people don't reply to me these days. I think they think I've gone crazy. I've actually changed my mindset about a lot of things recently. I think I've decided that I'm going to pretend that I don't care anymore. I'm going to care about the things I'm qualified to care about. I've got this idea about, you know, if you saw loads of cows in a field and you like jumped in there and you're like, come with me, I'm going to save you all. And you started trying to lift them over the lift them over the wall and stuff, you know. Yeah, you probably get trampled on, killed, but also be kind of pointless because, you know, they just wander back in again. So someone, my daughter sent me a podcast. Like I generally don't listen to people's recommendations because it's a bit like recommended shagging somebody. Do you know what I mean? Like you just got to, you know, work these things out for yourself. So I sent me this podcast, but for some reason she sent me the wrong link or something. I end up at a completely different podcast, the one that she wanted me to listen to. So it was a bit of a weird conversation where I was actually saying, oh, that's really interesting what they were saying. And she was, you know, it was probably something about people shagging their kids or something. I listened to this podcast and it was that guy, like the happiness guru or something, who used to work for Google or something. And he was, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it was actually quite good. It was a bit about his son dying and stuff. Don't want to spoil it. But it was actually quite good. But there was this thing about, you know, like during lockdown, like if you can't change something, then don't think about it. You know, just ignore it or something. Which for a while, I give it to Vanessa to listen to, and she likes it. That's the best bit. Like, but I think this, like, the idea of just not being bothered about anything is, I think if we all took that kind of attitude, then like nothing would ever change in a way. Like you still have slaves and all that kind of stuff. It's like, well, they like it, you know, like they're not complaining, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it is a bit of a, I don't know, it was a bit of a cop out, but I think, do you know, Graham Lynham, is it Graham Lynham who you wrote Father Ted and the IT Crowd? Like he's become like persona non grata. Persona non grata. You know, he's become, you know, like completely cancelled guy because he really went up against, he really didn't like the whole trans thing of chopping, you know, penises off boys and all that kind of stuff, and chopping your daughter's breasts off and all that kind of stuff for some reason. You know, he really took against that. So, and but he used to be like a real like lefty liberal kind of person. You know, he was like, you know, like cancelling other people and think it was great. But he's on a bit of a journey. So I listened to some podcasts with him recently, and you could see he was kind of, I don't know how far along he is, but I feel like I'm much further on that journey than he is. But he is still, he just sounds mental, basically, you know, because he's kind of schizophrenic. Like he's still got his Guardian, you know, reading, independent reading kind of mindset, but he's kind of rebelling against it. It's kind of weird. It's probably like people like lose their, you know, start losing their religion, but all their, you know, all the kind of ways of seeing the world is like biblical or something. I don't know. So I was like, oh, I don't want to be like that guy. You know, like I started looking at his Substack and stuff, and I was just, after a while, I was just getting like a message every day from him, like about something or other. I was like, oh God, it just gets a bit boring after a while. So so I just like stopped listening to him. But one thing I've realized recently is so things are actually what can I do that's actually useful to people, you know, if you keep rabbiting on about stuff that enrages you, you know, like, you know, sending tanks to Ukraine or whatever, you know, stuff that's actually kind of important, you know, World War III and all that kind of stuff, you know, just ignore all that kind of stuff. What can you do? You know, what can you do that's actually useful? But one thing I've noticed is I finally, you know, so I went through this phase of not having any mobile phone for a very long time, for several years. And then I had to get, when I moved back to Ireland, I had to get a dumb phone because of my bank and stuff. Like, I can't do anything unless I can get a text message telling me, yes, you can, whatever. So you kind of, anyway, so, but I can't, want, I want to listen to audiobooks on Audible. I have like an Audible account, but I can't listen to on anything for some reason. So I had to get, so I bought a mobile phone, cheapest mobile phone I could have to, you know, to be able to listen to Audible when I'm spending basically, like yesterday did like 21 kilometers walking around with this baby, pushing this baby around. So I wanted it for that. But literally it was like, you know, like train stopping or something, train spotting, where it was like, you know, you just have I'll just have a bit of heroin. Like, I've not had any heroin for ages. Like, I'm sure I can have a little bit of heroin. And almost like immediately, I was kind of right back in there of being this sight of a, you know, phone asshole of like, you know, on the kitchen table, like sending a tweet or looking, checking out maybe Instagram followers I've got and all that kind of stuff. And it really, you can see how it's only when you stop and then you start again, you can see. See how like how bad it is, and I know one couple who split up because the husband could not stop being on his phone, and I know two couples who are on that path, in that like, because and I see it, I just see it like everywhere, you know. I'm sure you've seen it yourself, and I'm sure you probably know yourself that you have the same problem. But it is like, I don't know, it's been, you know, like people talk about like porn addiction. It'd be like someone like wanking, you know, in the street or in the cafe or wherever. But, you know, like you'd be like, oh my God, that's kind of unhealthy thing to be doing. And kind of offensive and rude. Well, I think the phone thing is almost as bad, really. And yeah, so it's a kind of a double-edged sword. I put some app on my phone, so you know, if you go on Instagram or your emails or whatever, it says like 1 minute, 5 minute, or 15 minutes, and you can press on it, and it'll, you know, after 1 minute, it'll tell you, do you want to keep, you know, and that's the best I can do, really. Like, I try not to have my phone. I try to just have my phone when I'm outside. Like, I don't take it into the bedroom. I'm trying to control it, but it is like, God, yeah, it's a bloody toxic, thing, really. So anyway, but that's my news. So anyway, so I think I might try and crack on through some of these questions. Like, some of them are boring, like, no offense if you sent them. And some of them are very interesting. So I shall start with a very short one. This is from Jay somebody. I won't say who it is. Mr. Get Patrick, could you please tell me what setup or most common rappel device and third hand you use for a single rope, and please also your favorite combo rappel device and third hand for double ropes, also the brands. Thank you for taking the time. Write down. I think he might be from a foreign gentleman. So when do you rappel on a single rope? It's usually because it's like a fixed rope, I guess, isn't it? or if you're doing some sort of blocking kind of thing. But generally, you rappel on two ropes. Single ropes, like abseiling on fixed ropes is can be kind of complicated, because sometimes fixed ropes can be really bloated, like they can get really, really fat because they've just been left somewhere for a long time. They absorb moisture or whatever, they get really stiff, and it can be really hard to get your device through it. Sometimes if it's not too steep, you're often like better just going down like hand over hand on one of those kind of ropes if you can. Like there's a few like good techniques for, you know, where you use a carabiner brake will often work better on a rope like that, like a really knackered old rope, than an actual belay device. Especially if sometimes the ropes are, like often if you get a fixed rope, often it'll be tied in somewhere else, and the rope can kind of shrink, so you don't have enough rope to pull up to put through a device. So it's good to have some good, like a figure of eight is sometimes easier to use, but most people don't carry figure of eight. So I'll kind of ignore that, because you're basically just going to have the device you have. Like I did once have this device, it would only work on it was a really skinny, I think it was like DMM bugette or something. It only worked on like skinny ropes, like, you know, like 8.5, was it 8.5 ropes? So the idea was that it'd give you a bit more control over the thing. But then I think it was in Alaska, and then I ended up having to abseil, there was like a fixed rope, and it was like a 10 mil, and it wouldn't fit in the device or something. So it's good. It's basically, you want to have a belay device, rappel device that'll do everything. And the device I always use is a Petzl Reverso, whatever the latest one is. And like one thing is always worth pointing out, unless you have a device that has like steel parts to it, like my mum will have one with the steel parts on it. They do wear out belay devices, and they can wear out quite rapidly. Like you can wear out a belay device if you're climbing kind of intensively, like in 6 months, definitely within a year. And you don't want your belay device to wear out, because it's you will actually notice a massive difference. Like if you say you're climbing on some really skinny ropes, like 7.5 mil rope, and you're abseiling and it's free hanging, and your ropes are sometimes when your ropes are wet, they actually feel like they're grippier out there on your hands, but they're not grippier in the device. Anyway, but sometimes you can be like rappelling, and you say you've got like some rucksack or whatever, and it can be really hard to like control the rope. So the kind of designed, I guess, a sweet spot is probably like 8.5, 9 to 8.5, where they're going to work the best, you know, for paying out and fit and pay and feeding in and all that kind of stuff. So I've always found that those works really, really well. I guess you've got the DMM version is the pivot, isn't it? And you got the guide and all that kind of stuff, the Black Diamond guide. So you know, belay devices are kind of belay devices. I've not really used that many different ones for a while. And then to be honest, I tend to still, although like in my book down, there's like loads of ways of backing up your belay device when you're out rappelling, I still just go with the hand wear, just for, you know, if you're just rappelling like down one pitch or something, and you're stopping and starting, I'll generally just do it like that. But if it's like a longer rappel, then I will go to the, you know, like if I've got like a, you know, if it's a more kind of intense period of rappelling, like over a long way with like hanging belays and, you know, all that kind of stuff, then I'll just go with a sling off my belay device, off my belay loop, and I'll have my belay device like halfway up the sling with a carabiner at the top clipping in and out, and then I'll have my prusik loop on the belay loop. So I'm just, it's all kind of like in line, which is kind of the best way to do it. And there's various ways of, you can lark's foot the sling rather than lark, you can lark's foot the sling in the way where you end up with like, you don't have actually any knots that need untying. There's various ways of doing it. Just do it the way that's the most obvious way to you, really. So yeah, so that's an easy one to do. Like there's always like a better way. Having your belay device on your having your you know backup loop, your third hand, your prusik loop, your friction hitch on your leg loop is not like the ideal way of doing it, but it is the easiest, you know, the balance of everything. It works well, and you know it's universally used. You know, you can like there are you know, yes, there were technically there's better ways of doing it, but it works well. So you know, so yeah. So this is a more complicated one. I was wondering if I should keep the person's name secret. I'll change the thing. So, hello, Andy. Carefully read through your content online and learned a lot of things. I want to attempt the 270-mile bikepacking race. It should take me around 18 to 24 days. The weight and speed of camp setup, packing are absolutely key. I am still debating what to do as there is no perfect answer, but I was hoping you could guide me to make the best choice. The route goes from altitude varies between 4,000 feet and 8,000 feet most of the time. It's a good job I can tell the difference between feet and inches there. Unless it's someone who goes bouldering in the garden. Most of the time in June, the temperature drops to near 0 Celsius, or let's say -2 to 10 Celsius. Last year, I've done a lot of test ride. I've done a test ride using the Outdoor Research bivy and a 2-degree down bag, but it turned out to be terrible. One night, I was scared myself. I scared myself shivering out of control in the middle of the night. Oh, Noah's coming out of the sandpit. He's heading this way. Typical. I'm riding this road. God, he walks so weird. Oh my God, he's fallen over. It's okay. It's on the tennis court. Right. He walks like some sort of like Cockney gangster for some reason. I can hear him. Is he coming in? He's coming in. What do you want? Oh Christ. Noah? I think he might be distracted by something. To avoid getting all my gear soaking wet, I would remove clothes and put on my dry base layer. But dressing back up in the morning was just an awful process. Plus, having to dry everything every day took me valuable time. When I look at the gear from the woman who holds the record for this race, she was wearing a vapor barrier hot sack from Western Mountaineering. She was using a vapor barrier hot sack. It sounds like she would keep all their clothes on, long sleeve base, down vest, hard shell jacket, down pants or bottom. Sounds like a very quick setup, no sleeping bag. Last year's winner went with another approach, carrying only emergency bivy and relying on motels when he could. There is a fair good amount of hotel. Could be hard to coordinate the timing. But anyway, so my question is, if I'm going to carry only a bivy sack or a vapor barrier hot sack, no sleeping bag, should I go with something breathable or not? I think I would use the motels when I can and try and do short block of sleep when outside rather than a full night, and ride through the rain to keep warm rather than stopping, although that's easier said than done. I understand none of these options are great, but the goal of winning the race when options would be suggested. Oh, it's coming in. It's coming. Yes, I'm doing a podcast. I'm doing a podcast here. What do you want? Do you want some popcorn? Yeah. Do you know what this is? Yeah. I'm speaking to my people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I think I'm gonna have to pause this. Aren't I? I'm gonna have to go and sort you out, do something with you. Okay, I shall carry on this in shortly.
Right, I'm back. I'm determined to get this bloody podcast finished. This is about 3 days after my last attempt, and after I've had several attempts in between, I seem to be getting losing my voice as well. So all this trying to get this stupid podcast done. So anyway, so my son is back in the garden, and so hopefully he'll stay out there. So see if I can remember what that last that email was about, some cyclist going cycling. So I think it sounds like, sometimes if you're trying to come up with some solution to a problem like that, you're best kind of casting around to see what other people do in sort of similar circumstances. Now, it seems to be important that you can sort of deploy your system super quickly, and you can gather it up super quickly, and it has to be kind of lightweight, can't be bulky. It also probably needs to have like a high degree of robustness and kind of survivability in sort of sort of not ideal conditions. So you might be, you might be stopping and trying to sleep when you're soaking wet, which is not ideal. Ideally, you'd want to be like getting to hotels and sleeping in hotels and things, like you said. But you need a traditional like camping system where you stop and you put up your tent and you get your sleeping bag out and all that kind of stuff. Like, first of all, you're gonna end up having like, you're gonna have to have like panniers and all that crap, and before you know it, your tiny tent gets bigger and your sleeping bag gets bigger, and then you have like a mat and all that kind of stuff. So you need like a system where it will fit on your bike probably without any kind of panniers, and you can literally have it up and in your sleeping bag in 60 seconds or something, and then packed away and zooming off again. Like, I've covered this in the podcast before, but if you're doing like multi-day kind of things like this, you really want to be sleeping on 15 minutes to 40 minutes every 4 hours, and then you can like maintain that over like a long period. So you probably cycle until you're really, really tired, and then you just kind of like crash out, get in your sleeping bag, have like 15 minutes to 40 minutes, your alarm goes off, jump up, shove everything in, cycle off again, and repeat every 4 hours until you get to the end. If you got to like a motel, then you could potentially sleep for longer if you wanted to. But once you sleep over 40 minutes, you need to be sleeping, like a few hours really, to otherwise you'll feel worse. You'll feel worse for it. So anyway, so you need a system. You need some form of shelter. I need some form of insulation to sleep in. Like some kind of vapor barrier bag is basically like a plastic bag. So if you're super hardcore, you could just basically just carry a plastic bag, like a survival bag. If you had like a silicon, silicon nylon, bag or something, it would probably be that's probably your lightest kind of 100% waterproof, 100% not breathable kind of system, and you would just kind of jump into it with all your clothes on, and then you would like really, really like suffer and freeze your ass off and sort of boil in the bag. So you really want a system where you'd have to be like so tough to do it like that. You might as well just buy a plastic, one of those plastic survival bags. It'd be a lot cheaper for like, €5, and just shove it somewhere and just get into it. Sleep 15 minutes, get up, keep going, and just try and warm up on your bike. But it would be really grim. Like that, most human beings can't can't do that for and perform. You know, your morale would be so low, you'd just like you'd crash and you'd just give up because it'd be just be too miserable. So one group of people to look at for this kind of thing would probably be the army, like army types, because they're generally are going to be going somewhere, and then they're going to stop, and then they're going to have to rapidly set up some kind of sleeping system, and then they're going to have to rapidly break that sleeping system down and sort of head off and carry on. And so they're kind of the army types are basically the people who's developed the whole TARP thing, or basher as you call it in the UK, which is basically like a 8-foot by 6-foot piece of nylon, and with grommets or what. There's various types. Some of them wear absolutely nothing, like they're silicone nylon. They wear basically nothing, like bag of crisps or something. And so they would in the military, you generally you'd have like two. Basically, in the military, there's like two. You're in a team of two. You know, like two people, your buddy, whoever it is, and then is it like a platoon that's made up of, you know, multiples of two? Is it like 10 twos? Is it 12 people? I'm not sure. Anyway, you know, so basically, but your foundation unit in the military is two people, and then it like builds up from there. So you there's two people, and they both have a tarp. One person puts their tarp on the floor as a ground sheet. The other person, using various methods, cord, like power cord, bungee loops, whatever, then they'd kind of create a shelter. It could be like a ridge, you know, like a you know, you attach the tarp in the middle of the longest section, and then you sort of bring it down to like tent pegs or something. So you create like a tent shaped tarp, or you could have a tarp which is it's an angle. It's hard to do on a podcast. Anyway, you basically make some kind of top cover to keep the rain off you, and you can keep the wind off you and stuff. But you have to, you know, you have to pitch it very low. Now in the military, they tend to they'd probably pitch it very low down to the ground, so they'll get shot, and they'd actually dig a. I think if you're in actual war, you'd actually dig a hole. So you'd have your tarp is over the top of your hole, like a shell script. So it's like a foot deep. It's not like a trench, just like, you know. So you're just kind of under the level of the ground, so the bottom tarp is folded over, so it's smaller than the footprint of the top tarp, so the water doesn't all come in there. And but if you're not going to get shot, then you can have the tarp a bit higher. And a tarp, unless you've actually slept in a tarp is actually very, very effective, and is in many ways it's actually a lot drier and a lot more comfortable than sleeping in a tent, because there's very little damp air, because all the air kind of is just like blown away. So you're not like, if you get into if you're really, really wet and you get into a tent and everything's wet, your gear's wet, the tent's probably often wet if you have to get into it really, really, really wetly, then it just creates a real funk of kind of wetness and everything else. And it's pretty grim. Where if you actually have a tarp and you've pitched it properly, so you're trying to sort of block the wind and things, and you have like dry insulation underneath the tarp, you know, like a dry sleeping bag, dry clothes and stuff, then it can actually be like more comfortable than you know, like than being in your tent. That's why it's often, if you're ever doing like a long trip, you're often much better to bring a really like a good sized tarp and a much smaller tent than you think you need. And a lot of the time, you're not going to be in the tent, you're going to be like under the tarp. But same with if you're on a like a big expedition, you'll often have a, you know, create like an area where you're going to cook and do everything outside of where your tent is. You know, your tent can be like a tiny little tent, but you have a much bigger sort of living space. So it's kind of you're kind of creating like a living space, but here it's like a place to bivvy. But you're going to bivvy like super 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 quickly, and like if you know if you've got trees and stuff, it's kind of easy, or boulders or whatever. But in this case, you've got a bike, so there are like methods, very quick methods of like using a bike with a tarp. So you probably just throw your bike upside down on its handlebars, and you just you know, put the tarp up over the top of the bike. The front of the tarp is, you know, is on the front of the bike. Then you bring your two guy lines down, and then you just like peg out the back. So you could have, you know, you could have your tent set up in, you know, in 60 seconds. So and I would say like a very high quality tarp is the size of a tennis ball or something. It packs down to almost nothing, and it's, you know, if you go for some kind of, like, you can get quite a lot of like some tarps super heavy duty, but you can get some which are like military spec ones, which have like webbing that runs along the edges with it. Can you make it into a stretch? Basically, it's like super hardcore. You know, if you have like a super lightweight tarp and someone breaks a leg, and you try and, you know, six of you, each person grabs like a corner and two people grab the middle and try and carry someone out, it's probably going to split and the person's going to fall out. Where like a military one, you tend to have the two long sides have got like tape on them, so they're reinforced, and then the center line has tape on it as well. So what you do is you kind of flip it over, so you've got two layers of fabric where the person's being weighting it. Like a lot of hammocks, if you ever look at a hammock, hammock is like super lightweight material, but it's actually two layers of it, so it kind of reinforces each other. But you know, you don't want something like that. You want something as like light as possible. Now, I don't know who makes like is it Cascade? Anyway, but Rab bought them. But there's loads of people who make them, and you can make them yourself. You can buy that really lightweight silicon nylon. So that's what I would recommend in you know, just getting out of the elements. Now, it takes some practice, and you need some tent pegs. You know, maybe you take like four tent pegs. You could use like a knife, a fork, whatever, but you know, get some really lightweight tiny little tent pegs. You can use other things, but a tent peg's kind of good to have, and some cord. And you could just use like, you know, like 2 mil Dyneema or something. You could go like super lightweight. And so yeah, so that's what I'd recommend as a way of just getting your head underneath something. And then when it comes to what you're gonna sleep, what's gonna keep you warm. Now I would look at something. You want something that you can just throw over you and fall asleep. You want something as light as possible, and but also that's kind of robust. So if you end up sleeping in a, like, you know, when you're a climber, you often end up sleeping in like some grotty old toilets, and it's all wet or something, or you sleep in a bus stop, or you often can't be choosy about where you sleep, so there will often be, it can be damp and stuff, and that's a problem even with like a down sleeping bag. Is even in a tent, a down sleeping bag can be a bit of a liability, and it's kind of stressful. You want something where if you fall in a river, you could still, you know, get wring it out and sleep in it. Sorry. So a good thing I would look at is a quilt. Now you could buy a quilt like a. You could get like a down quilt, which would be, you know, like moderately expensive, probably less expensive than an actual sleeping bag. Or you could make one, but I would either look for to buy or make yourself just a quilt out of a synthetic sort of insulation. So then you don't have to worry about it getting wet, and you know, it's like one less thing to stress about. Like, even if it's on your bike and it gets wet, or you fall in a river, it doesn't really matter. Like, it's not going to be as warm if it's wet, but if you wring it all out and get all the water out of it, it's still going to, you know, keep you warm, which is something made out of down isn't going to do that. And the material you want the insulation you want to use is Clime Shield, which is the best kind of insulation. The best kind of insulation for that kind of thing. And because it comes in a sheet, it's, you know, like a lot of synthetic insulations, they're like, you'll buy like a brand new top of the range sort of Patagonia synthetic duvet jacket, like a softy kind of jacket, but you'll often find very quickly the insulation starts like breaking apart and you've got lots of cold gaps that it kind of floats around, and it's kind of a bit like down, really. It looks great in the laboratory tests, and you know, but it's often not so good over a long period. Where Clime Shield it's got some kind of scrim attached to it, so it's actually like a wad. Is it a wad? Anyway, it's like a big wedge of material, so it's actually very stable. So if you have a quilt made out of it, you can make it quite easily. Like I've made like quite a few myself. For some reason, I always lose them. But anyway, so you can make something like that. You could have to. If you're a woman, you're probably going to sleep a bit colder than a bloke. Like ideally, if you was two of you, then you could get away with something very thin and just like buddy up, which is very effective. But if there's just one of you, then it's worth carrying that extra bit of insulation to stay warm. Now, I would also definitely, it's no use having like a thinking about something to sleep, get, you know, sleep, a sleeping bag kind of system, if you don't have something to sleep on. So I would definitely invest in some kind of, you know, like mat. It could be like if you get like the lightest weight, 3/4 Therm-a-Rest kind of mat, you know, just get the lightest thing, the lightest, most compact thing you can. If you can't get a compact one, you know, like a roll mat or something is going to have to fit on your bike somewhere. But probably some kind of Therm-a-Rest. But the problem with Therm-a-Rest, it's actually, you're going to waste some time blowing up potentially, but you really do need something to lay on. Like you could, what would you have to lay on? Your pump or something? Your inner tubes? You haven't really got that much to lay on, unless you could find somewhere where you're laying on stuff that's, you know, not too hard. But if it's cold and wet and muddy, and you're not going to carry some kind of ground sheet to go underneath your tarp, then having a, well, I guess I would probably carry like some piece of material to stick your thing on. Otherwise, you are going to get really mucky and dirty. Anyway, so you do want to sort of strip off all your wet clothes if you can, because that's kind of going to be grim. And I would just like strip off all your wet clothes until you're naked, and then just get this. Then, you know, just what's the point of like putting on dry clothes if you're going to be getting up again in 40 minutes and setting off again? It's kind of pointless. And if you get in there with all your wet clothes, they're not going to dry in that time, and it's just probably going to be miserable. So you're just going to have to be really tough and just like strip down and strip it. You know, you could lay on top of it, I guess. That might dry it a little bit, but then it'd be kind of body temperature when you put it back on again. But like in the past, like putting wet clothes on was seemed to be quite common. Like having done like long sea kayaking trips, you generally only have like a wet clothes and dry clothes. You have one set of wet clothes, which is what you're kayaking in, and one set of dry clothes, which you wear when you're not kayaking. And you know, you do kind of have like a big, you just dump all these wet clothes at the end of the tent or wherever, and then put your dry clothes on and try not to get them wet, you know, going out to get water and stuff. And then you've got to put them back all on again, which can be grim. So like selecting the right kind of clothing is paramount. Like anything that you can wring out and that'll warm, you know, anything you can wring out, wring all the water out, and it's going to, the moisture in it, is going to warm up rapidly. So that's the thing. Like, you're not going to get the water out of your clothes, but you want the water in your clothes to warm up to body temperature as soon as possible. And that can take, you know, if it was like a, if it's a wet pair of jeans, you know, you're going to struggle. But if it's like a power stretch top or an R1 top or something that it generally has to be kind of fit quite well, and you're going to have to like block the wind, because the wind is going to, you're going to be battling the wind to try and, like, the wind actually does actually dry the fabric as well. The wind passing through the fabric is actually drying it. It's taking moisture away, but it is also like freezing you and making you cold. So you can't generate, you're not pumping out the heat that dries it out. So it's kind of a balance between the two. But, you know, you want to pick your active layer that you're going to wear when you're cycling that's going to be appropriate for, you know, what you're doing. So you're not in the idea of like doing a multi-day trip and thinking your waterproof is going to keep you dry is not going to happen. You're just going to be wet. So you're almost better adopting a system which is going to like slow down the ingress of water into your system, but then it's just going to keep you warm even when you're going to be sort of damp and stuff, and isn't going to chafe you. And you're going to get a lot of salt in your clothing from sweat, and that's also going to make it harder for your clothes to dry, to like fully dry. They're always going to feel damp after a while. So it's a tough thing. Like if you got to a hotel and you're really wet, one thing you want to do is just wash all your clothes in the shower and get the salt out, and then see if you can, even if you can't dry it, it'll actually dry a lot easier when you're wearing it if you get rid of all the salt out of it. So yeah, it doesn't sound very appealing, this race, if you've got to do all this kind of stuff. You know, if you're super hardcore, what would you do? I guess you would just get a tarpaulin. If you wanted to be super hardcore. So another thing to get is a Warby, which is your tarpaulin is based on a poncho. So in the past, in the military, you get a poncho, which, you know, like a poncho with a hood on it. And people were like, if you had to sleep, you would tie the hood off, tie a knot in the hood. And then you would suspend the poncho and sleep underneath it like a tent. And maybe you'd like snap two together to make like some of them, like some countries, you have the poncho things can be connected together to make like a teepee and all sorts of stuff. But anyway, so one thing that existed, or probably still exists, is a Warby, which is like a liner that goes inside the poncho. So if you're wearing the poncho and it was cold, it's like a synthetic blanket basically that fits inside the poncho thing, and it's probably like snaps in with some snaps or something. So some people like just carry, like in the military, they would just carry one of those and they would sort of wrap themselves up in it. by sounds of it, it's like they're not that warm. So, but you know, but you, if you're like super hardcore, you would just carry, you know, you carry your poncho and your Warby, and you would just, or a tarpaulin and a Warby, or but you know, like make up a bag, you know, like out of this material, like a survival bag, and you would like wrap yourself up in your Warby, and you would just crawl into it and sleep for 40 minutes and then get up and carry on, and you just sleep with all your wet clothes on or whatever. What else could you do? I guess it's very important to like have a lot of calories. If you're actually knackered and you're really starving, you're not going to be generating any heat. The heat you're generating when you're cycling is going to taper off very quickly as soon as you stop. So then you're just going to, you know, you're going to really going to be suffering. Like spotting the good places to stop. Like often if you're on like a, you know, if the weather's like horrendous, you know, you can get to a spot where you're protected behind something like a boulder or a dry stone wall or something. And suddenly it feels like really, really warm. Like you're like, oh, I could just like sleep here because it's so warm. and you kind of like lay down, and within about 5 minutes you're just like, you're freezing your ass off, and you're not gonna sleep in those. Like, if you're freezing your ass off, you're not gonna sleep, so it's pointless even stopping. Like, if you're absolutely exhausted, then maybe you'll sleep, but it's kind of pointless. Like, maybe you just better just keep going, you know, let's go slower. Or you know, if it's, you don't want to do this when you're cycling, but you can sleep when you're moving as well. Like, you have like micro naps where you're walking, and then you suddenly realize you were asleep, and then you're like, oh my god, I was asleep, and then you'll fall asleep again. And I think I've experienced that a few times. But once when I tried to solo El Cap in the day, I was having these like, I was in the middle of like leading a pitch, and I'd suddenly realize I was asleep. So, but that was when you not slept for like 40 hours or something. But I guess with all these things, you just need to keep practicing it. You need to go out and really suffer, but you probably suffer so much that you'd be like, oh, I'm not going to do this race. So maybe you don't want to practice it too much. It was like a thing, don't train for something that could kill you. You know, just do it. I think someone said I think I had to jump out of a plane into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, the Southern Ocean, out of a plane. And they said, why practice? Just do it. I think that's it. If you had to change into some clothes, like, one of the best things to carry for changing in and out of is actually back to the military. Is they had this thing called a zoot suit, which I think came about because when people were in the jungle, so if you're in the jungle, it's really, really hot and sweaty. So at night, you'd put your, tarp up, and you put your hammock up underneath it. And then you want to change out of all your wet clothes, otherwise you're going to really suffer, you know, inside your sleeping bag, inside your hammock. So so people have this thing called zoot suits, which actually, I think in the Second World War, that's probably where they came from. They were made out of parachutes, like basically silk pajamas made out of old parachutes. So it's just trousers with like a drawstring and like a top. And some of them would have a hood. Like, I don't think they wouldn't stop a mosquito, but a hood's kind of useful thing. And then, so this was like a classic item that people would get made, like in Hong Kong and places where there's lots of, if you're going through Hong Kong, you'd get someone to make you. There's lots of tailors in Hong Kong, apparently. In the UK, like if you were in, like my brother, he was down at like Bryce Norton where all the paras would be training. There'd be some guy in Bryce Norton who was really good with a sewing machine, and he'd be making these things for people, and people's wives were making them. You actually buy like a zoot suit stuff online, and some of it's like super cheap. It's made out of like the thinnest kind of nylon you can get. Pertex is probably the best material to get it made out of because it wicks. Pertex is like one of the best like wicking materials. So if you're like damp and you put on this, you put your zoot suit on, your bottoms and your top, it just absorbs all the moisture into the fabric immediately, then it wicks it over the fabric. You know, it sort of takes the water molecules and it sort of spreads them around, and then it rapidly, you know, you feel dry very quickly wearing it, and then your body heat dries out the fabric super quickly. So I've used that kind of principle for kayaking. And it works really well. Like, it's amazing how comfortable and warm you can be wearing just a layer of nylon, basically like Pertex top and bottom. So really, really good. But probably, you know, like if you could probably have some sort of cycling system where you were just cycling in your zoot suit, and then you just jump off your bike. And anyway, I don't know anything about cycling, so I'll stay away from it. How long have I been talking? I'm kind of aware that my voice sounds a bit weird. So I did have a look. Got some other questions here.
before my son reappears. That's asking me for something. I've got to take my daughter out for a walk in a minute. Don't want to spoil it. Don't want to give you all these problems. Let's have a look. I got like a file here with loads of stupid questions in. So this is one from. I'm doing this the wrong way around, actually, because it means the people who asked them longest ago aren't getting them answered. So anyway, hi Andy, thanks for your recent podcast. The one with the Yamaha outboard repairs in the background made an interesting listening. I have actually been doing. I'm like training because I've had this like all this baby crap to deal with. I haven't been able to do anything. I haven't been able to do any work or anything. And I'm just coming out of it at the moment. And I'm just doing like weight training like every day. Like I'm basically walking up to like 20 kilometers a day pushing this pram. So I'm at, that's for kind of exercise. I've just started going back and doing like weight training just because it's kind of, I kind of like it. It's simple and I kind of like it. So yeah. So I basically do like every other, I do overhead press and deadlift. And then the next day I do bench press and squat, and that's it. Like I just change every other day. I'm just doing those things, not doing anything else. And I do like three sets of five. So and I basically go up by 1 kilo every day on everything until the point where it'll get too heavy and I'll have to start changing and doing it every you know, spread it out more whatever. So it's kind of easy to do. And you can start on it, and whenever I do this I always start way below. Like with like weight training for me, you're always aiming at say doing like a body weight bench press, body weight overhead press, double body weight squat, double body weight deadlift, and you know you're always kind of getting towards that point, you know, after like months or years of doing it, and then as soon as you stop after a while, you're always like. You always drop back. It's like climbing. You drop that back. You know, you never drop back. Like you, the muscle memory of learning how to lift up weights is with you. So you got your technique doesn't really go away. So you can always move quite heavy weights just because you know how to do it. But your strength. You do notice your strength goes down. So I always like start back again. So I'd start at like half body weight. So you'd start, you know, for me, at like 50 kilos, and you'd start working back up again. So, you know, to begin with, it's like seems very easy. And then by the time it gets harder, then you don't want to be starting. Like today, I was listening to Garth Marenghi. I don't know if you've ever seen Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, Channel 4 TV program. Very funny. Anyway, I was listening to his, he's got like an audio book, the guy who wrote it, which is kind of funny. But I was like I was doing like a overhead press, and suddenly he said something that was like really, really funny, and it I almost like dropped the weight on my head because you kind of like bleed you're like bleeding this your power, your strength and your power by laughing. So anyway, so it's good, and I can generally get it done in the afternoon, like when Noah's having his nap, so I can get it done in like. I think the fastest I could probably get done is like half an hour, and I have like two bars, I'm warming up on one bar, and then when I start warming up on the other bar, and then they kind of overlap. Otherwise, it can take quite a while to do one and do another one. So anyway, I did have this idea actually doing a book called a book about, my wife's like, oh, that sounds like a terrible idea. I had this idea. I always have these stupid ideas for books. Like I have like so many ideas for books, and loads of them are so, you know, they never happen. And I've always got books ongoing. Like I have at least two books ongoing. I have one that's basically written and one that's half written. And the one that's written, I've just got to do the the diagrams for it, which takes forever. But I had this idea about writing this book. It's called Belly Timber, and it's about eating and exercising, and it's kind of like a pig farmer. Like this my German translator, he has a thing about, you know, pig farmer philosophy, which is like, you know, someone's view of something that they have nothing, you know, it's just like it doesn't matter because it's just, you're just a pig farmer, what do you know? But I think my relationship with food and weight and all that kind of stuff has been, I think it's been like very interesting over my life, like, because unlike a lot of people, like often I had to get really fat. So if you're going on a big trip where it's going to be cold and whatever, you have to get really, you know, you need to put weight on basically. I remember when I went to Antarctica, I had to have a medical, and when I had the medical, the guy was like, "Oh, I'm afraid you're obese." I was like, "Yes." And, you know, often you go on a trip and the people who were like super honed and, you know, they really would like start falling to pieces after a while because they had no belly timber basically. But anyway, I actually think it's really easy to lose weight. I think one of the problems about losing weight is people think it's difficult, but it's actually really, really simple. It's not fun to lose weight, but it's not that bad. It's not that bad. I'm basically losing weight now because I got really fat. Like I have this jacket that if I can't zip it up, I know I'm fat basically. I've got like a Montane waterproof jacket. If it won't zip up, I'm like, oh, I'm too fat. I need to lose some weight to get this jacket to fit on properly. And so that's basically like when I get really that fat, I'm like, right, I have to lose some weight. And I can always like lose the weight quite easily. I can lose about 10 kilos, 10 to 15 kilos of weight, which is like a shit ton of weight. Like at the moment, when I'm doing these walks with my child, I often carry like 5 kilos in a bag on my back, some rucking as they call it these days. And it's like, God, like 5 kilos is bloody heavy. So to lose like 10 kilos or five, you know, it's like I'm basically down 6 kilos from like when I started. But the weird thing is like my diet involves like eating like ice cream and stuff. Like I'll have like a whole tub of Haagen-Dazs ice cream or something, you know, just that's it, just for the whole week. You know? But no, but like I'm eating like mini, I really like mini eggs when it's Easter. If you're American, maybe you don't know what those are, but they're just like mini eggs, but they're not real eggs. Made out of chocolate eggs. And they're probably like 700 calories or something. So yes, it's kind of a weird kind of diet, but it's kind of, it's very effective. But I don't know why. Like, I think if I looked into it, like, was that Huber? Is it the Huber man? Huber guy who always writes about diets and all that kind of stuff and, you know, optimum fitness is, So I had this idea about writing this book and half of it would be my interesting stories about my relationship with food and like I wouldn't say I've ever been on a diet, but I just kind of change what I'm eating. And some things are, you know, some things are really good, and some things are really not really good. It's actually be a book where you could just condense it down to like 2 pages or something, a few pages. But it's like, if anybody's got any if anybody wants any diet advice, like, no, it's not diet advice. It's like you just need to make what you eat really, really simple. So you basically have to eat the same thing every single day. You don't have to eat it's not the same meal, but your life is so fucking boring that you have to fill it in with all this food, this fancy food. And it's the same way, do you know when people say, or people often, you know, people want to buy things because it makes them feel, you know, it makes them feel complete, or they think it's going to make them happy, like having a Porsche or whatever, iPhone 20 or something, but it doesn't. And food is kind of the same, is that you saw, you know, when you go for your coffee, you want to have your cake, and when you want your blah blah blah. So, but basically, you just have to sort of knock that on the head and realize that's just it's a bit like, also, you're not a child, like, why are you eating like a child eats, like going buying eating lots of Haribo or something? Like, they can't help themselves, but you can. So mini eggs don't count, and ice cream's like a superfood, someone told me. So yeah, this sort of diet is basically having like eating lots of food in like you're not really hungry when you're on the Kirkpatrick belly timber diet. You're never hungry, but you're also not like super excited. Oh no, you're asking, but there's like this thing about eating really boring food. Like if you ever go on a trip, it's like I've been on a trip where you're away for like 2 months and you have almost like basically the same food. Like you bring the food with you. Like there's no like popping to the shops. You have the same food, and after, you know, to begin with, it's okay. Like if you're eating dried food, if you're eating the same dried food on a big wall for like 14 days, then probably on about day 5, you start like really not enjoying having the same food. But then on about day 8, you know, you start enjoying it again. And you just got this, like, the problem of variety. Because that's the problem with like people wanting to like shag loads of different people all the time. Is there? It's not about the person. It's about themselves. As in, they're just bored. They're just bored. But anyway, it's just about simplicity. Is making your diet really, really, really simple, and you don't have to think about it. It's a bit like people wear the same clothes every day, which is actually also good advice. Is just have two sets of clothes. Or one set of clothes that are really smelly. But the food thing is, you just get up. Like I have for breakfast, I have 4 eggs. I have an omelette made out of 4 eggs. And I have some feta cheese. I buy one book of feta cheese and that lasts me 4 days. And you have to put it in a Tupperware box in the fridge. Otherwise, the water goes everywhere and then your wife shouts at you. And I have one tomato that I heat up in the microwave and then chop up and then throw it onto the thing. And the trick for making an omelette, you'll get really good at making omelettes. If you have an omelette every day for like months and months and months, potentially years, you get really good at making an omelette. Now, the trick with an omelette is you want to whisk your 4 eggs up and you want your eggs to be room temperature. Like, eggs don't go in the fridge. Like, what, are you an idiot? Like, you're going to eat them quickly anyway, so you know, you get through a lot of eggs. So you whisk your eggs, you chop up your feta cheese. You can crumble it with your hands, but it just gets everywhere. You put your thing in the microwave. You don't have to, but if you're soft, and then you need the pan has to be like, you put some olive oil in the pan. You could put something else in, but olive oil. And then you want to be like absolutely about to burst into flames, and you pour your eggs in. They'll immediately like flash cook, and they'll all start. It'll cook super fast. So as soon as you put it in, give it like literally 10 seconds, and then scrape all the egg into the center, and then let all the liquid like soak back around again, and then turn it down a little bit. Put on your feta cheese. Put in your tomato. Put some chili flakes on it. Put some pepper on it. And then when it looks like it's almost done, fold it in half. So you only put your stuff on one side, all your ingredients, fold it in half. And then you can leave it for a bit. Don't let it burn. And then you're done. Amazing. And then you have that. Then for lunch, you just have a baked potato. The one thing about this diet is you don't eat any wheat. So there's no bread or anything like that. So yeah. No cereals or anything like that. So that's some people find that difficult. And then for lunch, you have a bit of potato, and you can have some tuna with that. You can have as much protein and as much fat as you want, basically. But you can have some few baked beans if you want, whatever. Don't go crazy. You know, you want your calories to be about 2,500 calories or something, and then you. And then you, and that's it. And then for tea, you have I have some sauerkraut. It's good for your microbiome. Might have a baked potato, because another baked potato, lots of potatoes. And sometimes I'll just have that, but other times ideally I want some protein, so I'll have you could have some steak, or you can if you don't want to don't spend loads of money on your food, just have like one beef burger or two beef burgers. Play it by ear. But you're playing like a long game with this kind of diet, and then you can have your mini eggs. You've got to put your mini eggs in the freezer, so they're very, very cold, and you don't want to have, like, sleep is very important for a diet, so you don't want to have any caffeine after like about 3 o'clock. So you have I have my decaf cup of tea, and I have I have my mini eggs, and it's like heaven on earth. Sometimes I'll have a whole thing of Haagen-Dazs ice cream, but the way I visualize this kind of diet, and like every like your weight will go, like I have some like I have some of those like Fitbit scales, so I can monitor my weight like every day. It's like goes online, I can see what it is. And you know, you're playing a very long game in here. And I like to imagine like one of those things that fall out of trees, that spin around. What's it called? A whirly leaf. What are they called? Sycamore. Is it sycamore? No. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. One of those things that come down. But anyway, they come down, and that's not a good analogy because they just come straight down. But anyway, you want to imagine a leaf falling down, or a snowflake or something, not like a person who's anyway. But you know, and it comes down, and it wafts down slowly, slowly, slowly. Wafts. It goes up a little bit, but then it comes down and down and down, down, down. And it's like that, really. It's like, you know, some days you might be 500 grams heavier. Some other days, you know, you'll be like, you'll surprise yourself. And it's just a long, slow process of like getting down to your ideal, whatever your ideal weight will be. So yeah, so that's, anyway, so the idea was this book called Belly Timber. But I told Vanessa all this and she went like, that sounds like a shit idea. So so yeah, the other book, my thing's gone off now. My other book is called, do you know, like Jordan Peterson? Whisper his name. You know Jordan Peterson? He has this book like 10 Rules for Life. Like I'm very competitive. So I thought about writing my own one called 100 Rules for Death instead. Like in your face, Jordan Peterson. And this idea came about when I just saw about 4 people got killed in Patagonia. And I was like, that's so shit. I kind of feel it. A lot more, like I take it really personally when people die climbing these days. So I was like, what can I do to try and stop climbers dying? Like that's the reason I wrote down, is because I don't like people dying climbing. Like these days, I can't even watch like horror films. I started watching that. I might have said this already in this previous half of this podcast. I started watching that. Was it The Last of Us or whatever it is, what are those like fungal zombies? And I just had to turn it off. I don't like really violent things anymore. So yeah, so this idea about doing like, it'd be like 100 things. Like some things would be, you know, some things would be like really basic stuff, like how to belay properly or how to set up a belay or whatever. But very simple, like we want page of text and one diagram and blah blah blah. But then it'd be things like situational awareness, or you know, like the culture you're in, like, you know, often you can have a, you know, you, how old you, you know, the your gender, like men are more likely to die climbing than women and all that kind of stuff, because they're a lot better and stuff like that. So yeah, so I was thinking, I was going to ask Chris Bonington to do the, often I get someone to write, I need the title, then I need someone to write the foreword. And I thought if Chris, because Chris Bonington, I would have asked Doug Scott, because Doug Scott would have done it, but he's dead now. But like someone who's a real survivor, and I thought Chris might be a good person to, I'll have to email him. Last time I emailed him for his curry recipe, he never replied, so maybe he's not talking to me. So anyway, so I'm waffling on now. So anyway, I'll get back to this question. maybe anyway, so the man who was saying he liked my Yamaha thing. Oh yeah, that's why I was. Maybe I'll start after doing this. I'll start doing this podcast in the shed when I'm doing my training. Maybe a recording when on the water at some point. Yeah, I'll have to. It would be quite good to go. And the Yamaha engine is really quite loud. I'd have to do it out on the island. So a quote is giving me a quote here. Failure cries out for examination, whereas success, like charity, can hide a multitude of errors. Which is a quote from Erwin Rommel, the field marshal, which is very good. I'll read it out again. Failure cries out for examination, whereas success, like charity, can hide a multiple of errors. Achieving a goal, summit or destination can appear to be the only measure of success, but especially in your extreme situations, how close have you been to the edge? Sunk costs, while an economic model, costs which cannot be recovered, aka Concord costs, could this be considered, in brackets, or rather not considered, when assessing risk? Your decision when climbing with Vanessa in the snow to not push on, or when on the troll wall, minus whiskey drinking, salmon, trousers, Scandi types, and climbing down both appeared to me situations where you did not continue purely on the basis of efforts already extended, but on the benefit risk of future action. I'm rambling now, looking forward to any future output. Keep dressing like an Italian from Hull, Chaz. So that's a really good question. So, because I'm in semi-retirement from climbing at the moment, which I have both, like most of my life I've actually been in semi-retirement from climbing, but this is like the longest period of not doing any climbing. And to be honest, at the moment I have some doubts about ever doing anything dangerous again, because I hope my kids will not listen to this anyway, but my other son, like Noah, who's like 2 years old, maybe this is like changing me, why I don't like watching horror films, but I the feeling of just being away from him, because I've been so close to him because of COVID and all that kind of shite that went on, the idea of like going away is something like kind of distressing to think about, probably on both accounts really. So yes, that's something I have to kind of get my head round. And the other one doesn't really matter because she's too little. I don't really care about her. But so that probably was a factor with my other kids. But it's kind of a long time ago now, and I was also a lot younger, so probably I could sort of overcome those kind of things. I was a very different like parent then as well. So like not an okay parent, but not as good as a parent as I am now. So, but maybe it's like writing a book. Like, if you want to write a book, you need to write a book first in order to write your first book. So maybe to be a parent, a bad parent first to get an idea of it. So, but one thing I have think, I get, because I'm like 51, I'm at an age where I think a lot about the things that happened in the past. Like, as you get older, you're, in a way, your kind of opportunities sort of diminish. Like, I've kind of, I realise now that I've always been a very, like a lot of language, you can often get trapped by language. So you could say I was kind of self-destructive, or you could say it's a really simple word. I just can't remember what it is. When you wreck your own life rather than other people, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so often I would kind of do things that would actually reduce the chance of success, by how I did them, like the people I went climbing with, or the objectives or whatever. Like it was almost like setting out to fail from the beginning, which is probably true to some degree, because then it makes you feel like you're in control in a way. I think that like this, what's the word when you someone comes and oh god, what's wrong with me? I must be really tired. It's that stupid diet I'm on. You're all sat in there. You're all sitting there, listening, going like, "Ah, this is the word, you idiot." Oh god, I could ask Noah, but he won't. He's ignorant. I've been thinking a lot about stuff like that, and your opportunities kind of like when you're young, you have like very few opportunities, and as you get older, you know, you create more opportunities. Like sometimes things come to you, but generally you have to go looking for them, and then I guess as you get older, you tend to know more what you want. So you're more like it, you know, the old business thing. It's like, it's what you don't do, you know, which is almost more important than what you do. So you become more channeled in your, you know, you can't just be trying to get work off everybody and trying to impress everybody. You know, you like focus down onto certain kind of things. And, but you kind of realize you don't get as many opportunities as you used to, and partly that's down to, you know, like down to me personally, really. Like if you start spouting off about stuff and getting cross about stuff, like, you know, since I recorded the first half of this podcast, like someone sent me this some ice climbing festival with this poster called "Me and White Supremacy," where it was asking, you know, white climbers to do the work and think about their privilege and all that kind of stuff. And it's kind of like, don't respond to this kind of stuff, you know. It's just going to make people hate you or whatever. You know, you're never going to get invited to that. You're never going to get invited to that, you know, to that ice climbing festival if you start taking the mickey out of them by saying something like gravity is like bigotry. Gravity is like small-minded bigotry. It doesn't. It's colorblind. Anyway, I'm kind of aware. I think back about opportunities that I kind of, you know, came my way, and I kind of like fucked them up, or just ignored them, or didn't realize how amazing they were. But one thing I actually thought a lot about is how many self-sabotaging is often I had the opportunity to climb something or get to the top or you know, whatever, but I kind of self-sabotaged myself. Like when I went to Denali with Vanessa, I wasn't fit enough. I didn't really put any real effort into getting super fit, which I should have. It's because I just thought, like, I'll just get fit doing it. But there was so much time sitting in a snow hole, like weeks sitting in snow holes, I didn't really get fit enough. So when it came to the point where, you know, you're like, the top's there, like you just got to walk to the summit, I just wasn't fit enough to be able to feel comfortable doing it and getting back down again. So, and I can think about thinking back to like the times when I was most effective was when I really, really like, when I really tried to, you know, like often if I was going away somewhere, I would start getting my kit together the week before, which is often too late if you're doing something where you need specialist kind of stuff. So when I went to Denali, for example, I started getting my kit together, you know, like 6 months before, and I did a lot of preparation. So when we went to Denali, mainly because I didn't want Vanessa to freeze to death on Denali in the winter time. So, you know, so we went there, like almost everything was perfect. There's always something, right? If you're ever going to do a really massive trip like that, you really want to, like, say if you're going to ski to the South Pole, you really want to go to like the Hardanger Plateau in Norway, you know, like a few months before in the wintertime with all your kit. You want all your kit prepared for that, for like 6 months before, and you go to Norway and you do a big long trip and you realize things like, like our skis and our skins didn't really work in on Denali, our kicker skins. The pulk was too heavy and everything else for a kicker skin. And, you know, there's no way you can change that once you're on the mountain. So what, if you're ever going to do like a really massive, like if you're going to do like the spine race in the UK, you know, this big long race, you know, you want to have all your kit. You don't want to be doing it with anything new, any new kit. Everything you need, everything you have needs to be like, you know, like really well used. You really know how it's going to work. What's, you know, what's going to rub, what's not going to rub, what's going to, you know, you really want everything absolutely, you know, like about to wear out basically. And you want to have gone and done, you know, like a multi-day trips, you know, like you, where you go all night and stuff, and you know, work through all the problems. And I think that's one of the things I really loved about climbing El Cap is I generally climb El Cap a few times when I went to Yosemite. You know, you do the first, it's like a shake up, you do the first route and then you come back down and then you start like tinkering everything. And then you go up there again, and everything's so much easier because you just got your system set out, and then you do it again, and you're adjusting things. And I really love that aspect of big wall climbing, because it's quite complicated and there's a lot of stuff to sort of, you know, to work through. So I think often, like, I remember on, like, I think fitness is something I never, because I'm actually quite a lazy person. Like, I think fitness was something I never really put enough into, and maybe that affected, you know, that affected some things. And often when I climbed, you know, things which were quite physically difficult, often it was because I had put some effort into training beforehand. Like when I was doing more like alpine climbing kind of stuff, I was actually a lot fitter. You can take like your fitness for granted until you get unfit, and then you don't realize it, like aging athlete syndrome. So I think looking back is that I was kind of self-sabotaging, and I had put like the idea of now going back to Denali again. Like I would actually quite like to go back to Denali again, but not with Vanessa. No, only because we've got like these children now, so it won't be good to go back. Both of us. You know, like if I went back again, well, I know so much more now than I did before, even though I knew a lot before I went, but now I know even more that maybe you could do it without being as fit. But if I went back again, I'd be a lot more fitter, and I'd have all this experience of being up there, knowing where you go, everything else, and know what to expect. So you'd probably be, you're guaranteed to do it. But if you just done it right the first time, then you wouldn't have had this problem. You know, like, it wasn't the weather that stopped us. It was just, we just ran out of time basically. But, you know, why do you run out of time? You know, it's very hard to like second guess all these things. It's like a, you know, like the same with like climbing Mount Kenya. Like if we'd just gone and done, instead of doing like the traverse of Mount Kenya, you know, why didn't we just climb Mount Kenya by the normal route? And then by the time I went to try and do the normal route, like, I was, like, ill. So I can hear my son shouting. So, you know, going back to Mount Kenya, like, it's a lot. Like, why didn't I just get it done in the first place? And then you can just move on to something else. That's my son shouting, so I think I'm going to have to go now. Daddy. Yes, I'm doing my podcast. I don't even get this door open. I'm coming. Noah. Right, I better go. I think this is it for now. This is quite a long podcast in the end. And yeah. Oh God. Okay. Until next time, stay safe. Thank you.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.